Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, greetings of peace. The workshop that you all are attending this evening is entitled Muslim Law Enforcement Partnership. And just to introduce the workshop, I think it is fair to say that ever since terrorism visited our country on 9/11, both the Muslim community and federal, state, and local law enforcement officials have shared a deep sense of apprehension about the possibility of another terrorist attack. Shared in the sense that if another attack does occur, Muslims, on the one hand, will come under withering scrutiny, if not physical attack, and face the distinct possibility of their civil liberties being eroded. Law enforcement, on the other hand, they're charged with the responsibility of protecting the nation, and their apprehension is whether or not they are ahead of the curve in preventing another terrorist attack. And with the global situation being what it is, these are serious times for both groups. The stakes are high not only for Muslims and law enforcement, but for the nation as a whole. However, in this weighty atmosphere, a distinct pragmatism has taken root with both groups, with the mutual goal of protecting the nation and ensuring civil liberties are not violated. Law enforcement has engaged Muslims, seeking perspective, education, intelligence, and American Muslims have engaged law enforcement, providing information and background on a community that may not have well been known to law enforcement before 9/11. This evening, we take a pulse on how that relationship is doing and what the future holds. And we have with us, and I'm quite honored that we have with us, a very distinguished panel. To my immediate right here is Mr. Faisal Gill. He is a consultant to the Department of Homeland Security. He has a law degree from American University. He was with the U.S. Navy's JAG Department, or Judge Advocate General Department. He is also currently Lieutenant Commander in the Navy Reserve. He is also Deputy General Counsel for the Office of Personnel Management, Associate Counsel. He was also Associate Counsel at the White House in the Office of Homeland Security there, and he is also a Policy Director, or was a Policy Director, I should say, at the Intelligence Group at the Department of Homeland Security. We are very pleased to have Mr. Gill with us tonight. As most of you know, Sheriff Lee Baca is the sheriff for Los Angeles County, the largest sheriff's department in the nation with over 15,000 sworn and professional staff. You can see a listing of Sheriff Baca's jurisdictions and his accomplishments in our program. They are many and they are numerous. But important to note is that Sheriff Baca is Director of Homeland Security, Mutual Aid for California Region 1, which includes the county of Orange County, LA County, and 13 million people overall. Distinguishing his career and his practice and his management capabilities is that he incorporates innovative best practices into his leadership style based on proactive, progressive problem solving. And we'll hear more about the Muslim American Homeland Congress that he created, I'm sure, later on in the program. To his right, we have Ms. Serene Sawaf. She is the Hate Crimes Prevention Coordinator at MPAC. She earned her bachelor's in political science from Cal Poly Pomona here in Southern California. And she has spoken extensively on the misconceptions of Islam and Muslims. And has conducted media training with prevention training with over 2,000 students in Los Angeles County. She is also a coordinator of activities at the Department of with the Department of Homeland Security and local law enforcement. She sits on the steering committee of the Muslim American Homeland Security Congress, as recently created by Sheriff Baca, and also a member of the Multicultural Advisory Committee of the FBI Los Angeles region. Thank you for joining us, Serene. Finally, tonight we are honored to have Mr. Michael Rollins. a recently retired FBI special agent in charge of the Washington Field Office Counterterrorism Division. He is an internationally recognized expert in counterterrorism and counterintelligence investigations and operations, and recently joined the consulting firm of Booz Allen and Hamilton. No, that's not the right. I think that's the correct name. In his capacity with the FBI, he has developed and implemented national-level policies on domestic intelligence activities. He has come up the ranks of the FBI since joining it in 1974 and has served in various capacities in different cities throughout the nation. We welcome all of our panelists to this evening's event. I'd like to first start off with Sheriff Baca, if I may, and to give a perspective on the topic at hand. Sheriff Baca.
Well, thank you very much. It's a delight for me to be here. I just want to thank the Muslim Public Affairs Council for putting the conference together. I want to just briefly say that the panel here has many things to say, and I'm just going to kick it off with a fundamental message of what we as America can do for our Muslim American portion of our society. There are a number of things that I believe are critical to how we as a nation stay united with our various religions. I mean that we in America have a lot to learn about what it is to be a Muslim. And there's a number of things that I've done in the past 4 years to accomplish more enlightenment, but let me focus on one particular thing. In my travels across the country and meeting with various leaders within the American cities, and I meet as a member of the major city chiefs of police, a lot of discussion is emanating. A lot of things are on television, as you know. The world has shrunk in terms of information sharing. But when information gets shared that is essentially unenlightening, then attitudes will form that may also be unenlightened. And one of the more significant things that has happened in the world's audience that is not Muslim is that there's a perception that somehow Muslim Americans or Muslims abroad are not fighting terrorism, that somehow the voice of those who say we're against it is not listened to. And I think that voice has been loud and clear with the various organizations that we're familiar with here, whether it's COPA, whether it's the Muslim Public Affairs Council, whether it's the Islamic Centers. It's out there. CARE has been certainly working hard to get the right message out, and the Council of Pakistani Affairs and so forth. But the American public is not listening to this in the way that it should. So thus, because of that gap of perception versus reality, I gathered the most significant Muslim American leaders here in Southern California together about 4.5 months ago with the interest of mine of assisting our Muslim American brothers and sisters in forming a Muslim American Homeland Security Congress. Now, what is this? What is this Muslim American Homeland Security Congress all about? It's about having a voice that is credible to the purpose of protecting our nation and the world against terrorism. It's about having an educational tool to assist all Muslim families in understanding what leads to terrorism, whether it's isolationism or extremism or any other aspect of motivation, and that we would have goals and that we would have core values and that we would have a sense of leadership that is all Muslim to this organization, a nonprofit educational organization. So thanks to Shireen here on my right and a number of others in the audience that have been working diligently, at least 20 people from the Muslim American leadership side, women, men, Shura Council presidents, various people who are from various parts of the Muslim society are working diligently, and we have now reached a point where a board of directors is being established, and this nonprofit will in turn work diligently to develop educational tools for Muslim Americans and non-Muslim Americans. And we will work diligently to understand the needs of our federal system and our local system and how we can do a better job in protecting our country. That, in a nutshell, is what I think is missing here in the United States. And members of Congress, such as Adam Schiff and Jane Harman and others in Los Angeles County that I speak to, are very excited about this and are offering their help to make this work. And I believe that you'll hear more about this organization as it formalizes itself. And I would ask each and every one of you to think about it as a member. Talk about it. Ask yourself, what is my role in helping the country protect itself? And what is my role in being proud of being a Muslim American whose voice is going to get stronger and stronger and stronger? And my belief is that the voice of the Muslim American is the voice of any American. And we have to make that happen. So with that, that's my opening comments, and I appreciate you being here listening to this. This is an important part of the growth of law enforcement in the growth of America and, of course, in the growth of the world. Thank you.
Next we'll have Mr. Faisal Gill.
Assalamu alaikum. I want to thank MPAC for having me here, especially with such a distinguished panel as this. As Umar mentioned, I used to work at the Department of Homeland Security. I'm now a consultant to the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, so I do not work there, so anything I say here are just my views and not Homeland Security. So as a lawyer, we always have to get a disclaimer out there before we begin, so that's my lawyerly disclaimer here. The issue that I'm here to discuss today is Muslim partnership with law enforcement, and I think there really are two aspects to that. You know, one is how we as a community deal with law enforcement and how we partner with law enforcement, and then the second one is, as individuals, how we deal with law enforcement and how we, for lack of a better word, partner or cooperate with law enforcement. Sometimes the same, and sometimes the interests can be a little different, so I'm going to try to cover both of those as quickly as possible. I will say one thing, that the fact that Sheriff Baca is here really goes a long way to say how we have how we are partnering and how we've come a long way. When I used to work at Homeland Security, I was involved in the what's called the grants, USC grants that we used to give to certain localities. And any time the idea came up of giving grants to the Los Angeles area, it was always, what did Sheriff Baca think? And whatever Sheriff Baca thought, we basically kind of went with there. So I know this man's power. I used to hear about his name all the time, didn't really know what he looked like, so now I know what you look like. Having said that, let me just tell you some of the things that the Department of Homeland Security is doing in its outreach efforts from a law enforcement perspective, or kind of get the Muslim community together with our law enforcement components. The couple of cities that we've done this very successfully in, one is in Detroit. We actually have a formal program there called Bridges, where ADC and other members of the community come together on a fairly regular basis. It was monthly. Now it's gone to quarterly. It might go back to monthly again. And we discuss basically all the issues that are facing the community. And there we have all the components of the Department of Homeland Security. We have our Immigration Enforcement Division, then our Services Division of Immigration, TSA, and all the others. And basically we just get there, and the community shares its concerns and the issues that it's had, and we air them out. Some of the things we're able to resolve. Some of the issues we have to take back and come back for the next follow-on meeting. And some of the things we're just not able to resolve, but at least, you know, from a Department of Homeland Security perspective, what we tell the community is that your concerns are being heard at the highest levels, and we're hoping that's the message to go out with. We also have done this successfully in Buffalo as well. In Buffalo, as many of you might know, there was a little bit of an incident where folks were coming from the border, and it caused a lot of concern in the Muslim community. And we went down there. We, again, got the Homeland Security entities together. The U.S. attorney there was very helpful getting everybody together. And, again, we're able to set up a system where there can be a regular dialogue between law enforcement at the federal level and the leadership of the Muslim and Arab community, which I think is essential. And then in Los Angeles, we're also starting a similar dialogue. We had one a little while ago. We're going to have one again in January, and then we're going to continue on from there as well. So these efforts I see as very positive in bringing the Homeland Security and the Muslim community's concerns out on the table and seeing what we can resolve. And having said that, we as a community need to, again, understand what the role of law enforcement is. I mean, their job is basically, you know, law enforcement, to protect. And to defend. It's not outreach sometimes takes a backseat in that job in accomplishing their mission. And certainly in Homeland Security, we've known that it's been a little bit slower than we in the community would like. Part of that is because the department is new. Part of that is because they're just focused on law enforcement. And sometimes it is difficult to talk to law enforcement officials because they're just so focused on one issue. However, I'm learning and I'm finding out that most law enforcement, at least in the Homeland Security area, are coming to the realization that they can't really do their job effectively, especially in the area of immigration enforcement and terrorism, without having the assistance of the Muslim community. And there is a genuine feeling of that. Sometimes, you know, in all honesty, they don't really know what to do with that feeling, but there is at least that realization that we need to come together with the Muslim community and we need to get a regular dialogue going. There's a little concern that, you know, there are things that they're doing that we certainly don't agree with that they, for various reasons, cannot change. But what I always tell them is, look, at least we're telling the community that. At least we're at a table, at least we're talking, and at least we're basically saying, look, we're not going to be able to accomplish everything that you want, which I view as a very, very positive step. One of the things that I think we need to do as a community is we need to get more of our folks in law enforcement. I mean, it's not really a career path that a lot of folks take. I took a quasi-law enforcement career path, not really law enforcement, a little bit different. My brother is in law enforcement. He is an FBI agent, one of few. There are others out there that I know, but certainly not enough. And I think we need to, when I talk about law enforcement, I mean everything from your local police department and sheriff's office to FBI to Homeland Security's various offices, and also the U.S. Attorney's offices are also crucial in this law enforcement arena. The more Muslims that we can get in there, that's the best way of having a lot of our voices heard. One of the things that I realized was when a lot of these agencies were retooling, and again, I'm speaking at the federal level, retooling their missions to kind of deal with terrorism and the current mission, they really didn't know what to do. I mean, they didn't have any Muslims that were around in their departments, so there is a little bit of ignorance there, and they're trying to fight through that, and they're trying to correct that. I think if we get more Muslims involved in law enforcement, I really believe that can change, and that would really help us as well. Now, that is easier said than done. I mean, I know as growing up, now this might just be a South Asian thing, I don't know, but my parents, the career choices to me were doctor and engineer, as you can figure. I didn't pick either one. Lawyer was kind of on the outside. It was, okay, Berta, you'll make a lawyer, that's fine, but I mean, if I would have gone, like my brother, I mean, he went to law enforcement, and my mother still tells him, when is he going to get a real job? But I think that attitude really has to change. I mean, if we really want to make a difference, we have to get most of our people in law enforcement, and I just can't stress that enough. And if we don't, then I do think that we're going to be selling ourselves short in the future, especially if there are other problems that we're going to face, like other attacks and whatnot, which, unfortunately, I think there is a good possibility for. The last thing I want to kind of focus on is how we as individuals deal with law enforcement. There's a lot of concern in the Muslim community, and every event that I used to go to, whether it was a social event or whether it was a formal conference, especially when I was at Homeland, one question that I was always asked is, should I be talking to the FBI or should I be talking to this law enforcement agency? They came and talked to me. I don't want to deal with them. What would you do? What do you advise? Obviously, when I was at Homeland, I advised differently, but now, I'm not going to say we shouldn't cooperate with law enforcement. Absolutely, we should cooperate with law enforcement. It is in our benefit to cooperate with law enforcement. However, that does not mean that you give up your rights. That does not mean that you don't say to, if you feel so inclined, that, well, I think I'd like to have a lawyer present as I am, at this interview. You're not going to be looked upon negatively. There is a misperception, and I really want to say it is a misperception that people believe that if they say they want a lawyer, whether they go talk to the FBI or ICE or other law enforcement agencies, that they will get in more trouble and they can just easily resolve the issue just by talking to the person and that's it. That is a big misconception. I mean, I will point out to you when fairly powerful men and women in Washington have to deal with the FBI, they always have their lawyer present. And I'm talking about senators, congressmen, and even the president. They have their lawyer present. Again, I'm not saying it is a requirement that you should always have your lawyer present, although I am in private practice, so please, lawyers are very nice. We should basically remember what our rights are, and we should not be afraid. And that is a really word that I want to use again. We should not be afraid to exercise our rights in front of law enforcement. I mean, obviously a police officer, as he's doing his investigation, or an FBI agent as he's doing their investigation, would like to have you by yourself. That's the nature of their job. I don't blame them for it. That's just, the way it is. However, they also recognize that you have a right to a lawyer and that you have a right to either not talk to them if you don't want to talk to them. And I don't think they're going to hold that against you if you do exercise your rights. So that's, I would kind of focus on, that's how I would say we should deal with law enforcement on an individual basis. But I definitely think that we need to cooperate because, we say, and the theme of this conference has really been that we need to be involved in the war on terror. And I really believe that we as a Muslim community have more at stake than anybody else because the war on terror is affecting us. I mean, we're going about our business. And if we are going to say that and if we are going to believe that, then we need to effectively be there when law enforcement seek our assistance to fight that war. And again, I think the best way we can do that is getting people in law enforcement, cooperating with them when we can, but not giving up our rights in doing so. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity to be here to share some thoughts with you, and more than me talking to you, to listen to what your concerns are and hopefully answer them. I've heard some very interesting questions in some of the other sessions. I've heard some incredibly inaccurate information by some of the speakers, and I think the reality of today's world is you can deal with all the rumor and gossip and innuendo and hype and hyperbole you want, and you can have all the surface conversations you want, but if you really want to be part of the community and part of the solution and part of the team, you need to get into the substance of the issue, and you need to not be afraid to get into the substance of the issue. Same disclaimer, I'm no longer with the FBI. I retired a month or so ago after 31 years. I served the last 3 years as the head of the counterterrorism division at Washington Field Office, and the 3.5 years before that as a section chief working international terrorism. I think to understand where we are today and from the law enforcement perspective, and I'm going to try to keep it Washington, D.C. centric, because I think that's what we're here to talk about, is how we're working with the community and what we've done. But the reality was, the day that I came back to Washington from Boston in August of 1998, the FBI had 630 special agents working international terrorism around the world. 630 around the world. 56 cities in this country, major cities, 400 satellite offices, what we call resident agencies, and somewhere between 40 and 45 legal attaché offices. Compare that with a department of, what did it say, Chief, 15,000? Ray Kelly up in New York, 35,000 to do one city. I was a math major, so I always tell people, you know, do the numbers, do the math. Was terrorism important to the FBI back then? Sure it was. So was white-collar crime, and so was violent crime. So in all of your worlds, I would think, is the issue that we have in this country with drugs, public corruption, and on and on and on. We went in 1998. The embassies were attacked the week I got back. We had never had an FBI agent ever in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, or Nairobi, Kenya, ever. We had one FBI agent stationed in the entire continent of Africa. And we deployed about 300 agents into a land where we'd never been and got phenomenal cooperation by the local services to the extent that 21 days later, people were in jail in New York City. And we would go from Dar es Salaam to Nairobi to the downing of Egypt Air 990 to the Kosovo deployment to the Millennium attacks, the conspiracy to attack with Ahmed Rassam coming across the border from Canada into Washington, to the attack on the USS Cole in October 2000, 11 months later, the September 11th attacks. So they kept coming, but primarily they kept coming overseas. And as a country and as a government, we said that's kind of the cost of doing business. And that 635 number that I told you about in August of 1998 was where on September 11th? 530. Attack, 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 105 fewer agents on September 11th. So what is it important? Remember that, you may or may not remember the country song if you're not a country fan. There's a song, I was country when country. I'm insulted by the people that say that nobody was taking the quote-unquote war on terrorism seriously. The 82 people that worked in that section when I was there, now 1,200 on the flow chart, gave up more nights and weekends and holidays and family time and community time and time with the kids' school than I care to think about. But a lot changed. Personally, I went over to the Washington field office, and the thing that jumped out at me, it was the only office in the country that has a squad of agents that deploy overseas and exclusively work investigations of attacks on Americans. Doesn't matter what their race, religion, sex is. If you're attacking Americans against the law, we're going to go find you. It's as simple as that. And whether it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or in the case of Robert Steetham, who was dumped off TWA-847 on the tarmac, some of you old remember that hit in the evening news, met with his parents in Washington on the 20th anniversary. And the warrants that we have against Imad Bugnia and Hassan Izzeldin and Ali Atwa are as good today as they were 20 years ago, and they'll be good 20 years from now. Because we think that that's important, that when people attack us as Americans, there ought to be a price to pay. So on September 11th, the world woke up to just what was escalating all along the way, and not enough people were paying attention to it. We as a country did not have the political will to do anything about several of those prior attacks. Stop and think about it. On June 25th, 1996, when 19 brave airmen died at Khobar Towers, how is that not an act of war? When the USS Cole, an Aegis-class destroyer, comes within inches of sinking in the port of Aden, how is that not an act of war? And what did we as a country decide to do about it? The simple answer is nothing. What's the difference between September 11th and those prior attacks? Might sound cold, numbers. Two differences. More people died, and they die here. And all of a sudden, the world changed. We call it a war on terrorism. I don't like that phrase at all. I hate the phrase connect the dots because it makes it sound so simple. Connect the dots is something to do in second and third grade. Not that easy. I'm preaching to the choir talking about the difficulties in the Middle East. I think if it were easy, somebody would have solved it a long time ago, wouldn't they? I firmly believe in homeland for the Palestinians. I always have. When I traveled over there and I looked at the situation on the ground and the border checkpoints and coming in and out of different areas, I thought to myself, you know, I'm not the smartest guy in the world. This isn't going to work. And nobody's more hopeful than I am that it does work, because I think a lot of those of us that work counterterrorism investigations gets a lot easier if we can find a way to find peace in the Middle East. So I arrived in Washington field office. Look at this team that's deploying all around the world. Got that down pretty well. What don't we have down? I couldn't tell you the name of a single official in the Arab American Institute or an MPAC or an ADC. Never met them. Never had a conversation with them. And we said, well, that's got to change. So we brought the leadership in, and we formed the first FBI Arab American Advisory Committee with the leaders of all these organizations who, interestingly, because their organizations are headquartered in Washington, many of them, they meet with the director of the FBI as well. So our message has to be in sync with what his message is. But my bottom line is we need to have better relationships with the community, and these are the people that can either get us into the community or, quite frankly, keep us out of the community. Our detractors, they aren't many, they are few, have taken a different position. You, FBI, are nuts. You shouldn't talk to those people ever for any reason. The article in the New York Sun that was referred to this morning was just a follow-on to this whole thing. All I do by being here is give MPAC credibility. All I do by meeting with Emad Mohammed Majid at the Adams Center is give him credibility. And that's a bad thing in the view of some people. It's not my view. My counter to that is, oh, really? Was it not the Bush administration that invited Imam Mohammed Majid to the Reagan funeral ceremony at the National Cathedral? So who's given who credibility? And I think he deserves credibility. If you read the Time magazine article on him last month, if that's not the kind of person within your community that the FBI should be dealing with, and Sheriff Oka should be dealing with, and the rest of our counterparts around the country should be dealing with, then I don't know who is. I haven't met him or her in the last 31 years. So I tell my critics, we're out there. We need to be in the community. When I talk about we, I mean the plural. We, the law enforcement community, need to be there. And I understand that there was some, I wish I was at the seminar next door prior to this one, because I would have asked the follow-on question when there was a concern voiced over the Iraqi interview program. Having testified in front of the Judiciary Committee on the detainee issue, I can tell you right now that being in the community, talking to people who can help us, and that's the difference in my view. In 31 years, my interview approach was always the same. Knock on the door, show them the credentials, hi. My name is Mike Rouse, I'm with the FBI, and I need your help. Every single interview. Unless I had an arrest warrant, that was a different story. Prior to the Iraqi invasion, the government made a concerted decision that we were going to go out and interview about 4,700 people. Why? Because we needed their help. It was a force protection issue. Back then, everybody thought there was WMD. We wanted to know where the weapons caches were, and we wanted the help of people who traveled there, who had relatives there, who maybe worked in the industry there. It was probably, in Mike Rouse's view, one of the smartest things we did, to go out and knock on doors and ask for help. And one of my anecdotals, had two women come to me in the office and say, Mike, forget it, we're not doing any more interviews. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, we can't eat any more cookies and drink any more tea. And that's something that I learned about your community. When we got the criticism about what we did and did not do in San Diego with Khalid al-Mihr and Nawaf al-Hazmi, I said, well, they befriended these people, and they found them a mosque to go to, and they found them apartment buildings, and they found them restaurants. I said, well, guess what? That's what the Arab American community does. They are the most hospitable, gracious group of people that I've come across since I started doing this. But I'll admit to you, I was incredibly naive when I took that job, and I did not have the knowledge base that I needed. And when we first started going out to the mosques on Friday nights and doing the town hall meetings, boy, you could cut the air with a knife. The animosity was incredible. We were distrusted. We were, in many cases, not welcome. Your colleagues felt, and I hear this word all the time, targeted. You're targeting our community. And the way I respond to that is I say, yes, I'm targeting you for your help. I can't think of a single investigation I ever conducted in my career that was done solely by the FBI or by the FBI and the sheriff's office or the FBI and the police department. The essential ingredient, and the chief referred to this earlier, is the community. When Watts was burning, it was the African-American community we needed. We have a border issue. We have drug issues. It's other communities that we need. When the IRA was going crazy in Boston and an individual was trying to develop a better capability to use Stinger missiles to bring down Army helicopters in Northern America, it was the Irish-American community we needed. Different issues, different communities. And the issue of today is turn on the news. It just resonates. It's our need to gain your trust and gain your support and work this issue as a team. And I'll close with one last comment. I was reminded when someone else was talking about the need, when Mr. Gill was talking about the need to have more Arab American, more Muslim Americans in the FBI. that to me is a telling point of just how committed the community is to being part of this partnership. I was asked that at one of the town hall meetings with a finger pointing in my face. Why don't you have more Arab American? Why don't you have more Muslims, more translators, more agents? And I turned it right back and I said, well, you tell me. Who's more likely to be the convincing voice out in this community to tell people what the value of doing just what my colleague said, of being part of the solution? You or me? I spend a lot of time recruiting. I understand the need. There is a tremendous need for more of this capability, but it's got to come from the community. And toward that end, I solicit your support. I applaud the efforts of my colleagues, and I look forward to answering your questions at the end of the commentary. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto all of you. As the community voice on this panel, I feel a responsibility to take a step back and define partnership and cooperation, because from conversations with community members, I'm aware that those may raise red flags in many minds. So when we say partnership and when we say cooperation, it is not that we are planning to enlist in the FBI or become the mouthpieces of law enforcement or the arms that execute the tasks that they must execute. But rather, it is to join hand in hand and partner in protecting the country that we all live in. That said, it's important to assess the need for partnership. Why is it valuable to the government and to this country? First of all, as we heard earlier today, we know that Muslim Americans are best equipped to win the battle of the hearts and minds of the Muslim community, of the public, of this country, and beyond. Second, given the skills necessary to be able to detect suspicious behavior, Muslims will be best equipped to distinguish that suspicious behavior from cultural behavior, thereby eliminating the possibility of, or at least the potential, minimizing the potential to violate civil liberties, and rather focus on real threats. Third, we alone can ensure that our religion is not hijacked by those who take it and manipulate it, and we are prepared to counter bad ideology with good ideology. If this is in fact an ideological war, we must counter it with positive theology, positive ideology. And something that brings light and sheds light on this area for the country and the community is to see that in a recent poll, which was talked about earlier today, but I'll go ahead and discuss it briefly, a poll conducted at ISNA's convention in the East Coast in Chicago, by MPAC, we surveyed approximately 200 youth between the ages of 14 to 26, and 94% said, despite their disagreement with American foreign policy, they believe that Muslims should engage with government and engage in the American political process. So it's beneficial for the country and the government. Why does the burden fall on the Muslim community? Does it in fact suggest that we are suspect? Does it in fact suggest that we have terrorists lurking in our mosques? I beg to differ. Taking it back to the religious text, we know, we're all very familiar with many verses, one being from Surah 3, verse 104, let there arise out of you a community of people inviting to all that is good, enjoining what is right and forbidding what is wrong. They are the ones to attain felicity. And again, I emphasize out of you a community, emphasizing the democratic process, shura, if you will. And second, if we all know that one of the goals, the underpinnings of Usul al-Fiqh is to prevent harm. Prevent harm towards the individual, towards the family, towards the community, towards the society, towards the nation, towards the international scene, and in the environment, take it in every realm. The idea is to prevent harm. So it is not that because we are operating under the assumption that we have terrorists lurking in every door, in every institution, but rather we have a heavy burden on our shoulders that comes not from man, but comes from God. Now, we're hearing a lot about partnership and a lot about the need to counter extremism following 9/11. However, these partnerships did in fact exist prior to 9/11. And to touch on a few, I think it's important to recognize that the FBI was responsible for foiling the plot of the JDL members, Irv Rubin and Earl Krugel, their conspiracy to bomb three distinct Muslim or Arab, because it was Congressman Daryl Issa, who's half Lebanese, King Fahd Mosque, and at one point it was Muslim Public Affairs Council or office. Planning to bomb these, it was only with the swift operations of the FBI they were able to prevent that from happening. Many dialogues also took place, and furthermore, there were trainings prior to 9/11. After 9/11, however, it's important to see that we focused due to the need to address a different set of challenges facing us. And while we have made many strides in the past 4 years, it's important to recognize that we do face challenges in this partnership today. Before I go into the critique or the challenges that we face, I think it's necessary to recognize that the FBI, the U.S. Department of Justice, the Sheriff Department, Department of Homeland Security have been absolutely amazing in reaching out their hands, extending an arm to the community and saying, we want to hear from you, we want to know your concerns, we want to work with you, not against you. So, that said, I think that the panelists here today must be commended, along with Norma. Norma Loza is also here with the FBI. She's the one of the point people in the Multicultural Advisory Committee that was talked about. And I think it's in her colleague, Vaviette. Thank you. Okay. Now, we recognize that many positive steps have been taken. However, recently, if you ask the average community member, all that they have heard about in terms of what has been taking place in partnership or outreach towards the community has been nothing more than interrogations, investigations, deportations, detentions, very negative, consecutive, back-to-back, overwhelming issues. We have Chaplain James Yee with us here today. We are familiar with Sami El Arian's case, both of whom were found guilty in the court of public opinion, yet found innocent in the court of law. However, at that point, it's too late because their reputations have been stained. Now, second, the community has yet to be viewed across the board as part of the solution rather than part of the problem. Again, while the members sitting here today are excluded, they're in my engagement with law enforcement through trainings, through whether they be cultural sensitivity trainings or awareness trainings, I have recognized the constant question that alludes to the assumption in the minds of law enforcement that mosques and institutions and the community must be monitored. That for some reason there's a perception that the mosques are breeding grounds for terrorism, that imams are inciting violence in the mosques, and that our institutions must be thwarted and we must find terrorist financing and get to the bottom of that because it's all over the place. Well, again, that's a misperception. We have yet to see mosques accused and found guilty of breeding terrorism. We have yet to see individuals accused and found guilty of inciting violence at the podium, at the pulpit. Third, a mechanism that connects local with national for partnership is essential. Now, aside from what Mike spoke of, there are two main mechanisms in local Los Angeles I want to highlight, one being Sheriff Lee Baca's Muslim American Homeland Security Congress, the other being the Multicultural Advisory Committee, both of which are forums where community and police, whether they be FBI or Sheriff Department, have a back and forth dialogue, are able to raise issues. We are able to bring issues to their attention and have them resolved. There is quick response in terms of what we've seen with the FBI in looking in cases when we have questions. And we need to reciprocate that. We need to make sure that the community is very aware that these things are happening and that the law enforcement members that we are partnering with have the best interests in mind. However, this disconnect between local and national remains to be a problem. We are lacking briefings on policy on the national level. Our concerns and solutions, our suggestions, our advice must go to the highest level, and I say that in terms of the Attorney General, the FBI Director, and they must be taken seriously. Prolonged discussions that lack resolutions make the waters run dry, and we're not interested in that. And third, counterproductive counterterrorism efforts must be isolated, marginalized, and thrown out the window, quite frankly. We have high-level officials that have entertained agenda-driven Emersons and the likes, and actually humored him by taking into consideration his prejudicial guidance when crafting policies. We had a program that I have to highlight quickly called Partnering for Prevention, initiated by Northeastern University, which was killed. It was a $1 million grant that was killed due to Emerson's lobbying on the Hill. How are we going to rest assured that these efforts and our progress will not be killed? The solutions I propose in my last couple of minutes are the following. Despite all these issues, the American Muslim community has remained transparent, and we believe fully in complete disclosure. Our charities have been looked into, and we came out with something called the National American Muslim Nonprofit, the Council of National Council of American Muslim Nonprofits, excuse me, to say these are best practice guidelines by the community, for the community, that can be instituted to say we're clean. Mosques, we launched national campaign, anti-terrorism campaign, to encourage mosques voluntarily to take upon themselves best practices, again, to say we're open and we're ready to protect this country and protect our mosques. And finally, it's important, excuse me, not finally, but definitely not finally, but it's time for government to do the same. It's time for government to come forward and say we are willing and ready at the highest levels to meet and consider policy recommendations. We must go beyond trainings. We must go into the core. We must have constructive engagement. And again, we can't completely blame the media for the lack of coverage, right? We talked about the fact that there are handfuls of law enforcement that have recognized our efforts condemning extremism and terrorism, yet the national landscape has yet to publicly acknowledge that. Why haven't Muslims condemned terrorism? Why haven't they condemned extremism? It is not simply the media's fault. We have to ask ourselves, what can we do with this partnership that makes news, that is beneficial to both us and the country? I think it's important to take recommendations from the Prime Minister's Task Force on Counter-Extremism. They propose that along with countering extremism, we must counter anti-Islamic rhetoric. Now, these are all steps towards constructive engagement. Why? Because constructive engagement leads us to strengthening the fabric of the country, which leads us to fostering pluralism, which leads us to guarantee true democracy. I leave you with a quote from Aristotle: if liberty and equality, as it's thought by some, are chiefly to be found in democracy, they will be best attained when all persons alike share in the government to the utmost. And I think that is the task set forth for the American Muslim community. Thank you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much to our distinguished panel. Quite an enlightening. Please give another round of applause for everything we've heard this evening. We did want to allow some time for Q&A, and so Sahail here to my right, your left, will be give you a microphone to ask questions. I do want to emphasize that this is a question session, so please limit your questions here.
Oh, it's for Sheriff Lee Baca before you go. I catch him before he goes. He's under arrest. Okay, sorry. Actually, I have a lot of admiration for him. He's a great sheriff and very kind and human. Any efforts on the sheriff department for recruiting among certain minorities, Muslims or Latino, whatever it is, do you have programs like that to recruit people for the sheriff?
Let me say that the Sheriff's Department is extraordinarily inclusive in everything that we do, because we recognize that Los Angeles County as a model of government is like a nation in itself. We have people all over the world here. All the religions are here. I have an interfaith religious council made up of all the faiths. We have advisory councils. I have South Asian Advisory Council. I have an Indo-American Advisory Council that breaks out from that as well. I have Iranian American Advisory Council. There are, of course, the Muslim American Homeland Security Congress that will form not only here in Los Angeles County, but it'll form nationally, internationally. I'm planning a trip to Detroit. That seems to be the next place for us to start the process of that particular regional chapter. Salam al-Mariardi, who is, as you know, the executive director of the public affairs, is very, very involved in helping form the national strategy here. All terrorism is local, so this is not something that is just Los Angeles alone. But the thing that is important for us to acknowledge is that we are emerging. All the things that the panelists have said, along with myself, we are emerging and creating a world in America for all of us that we would think would be better. And so the commentary, whether it's critical or positive, either one, is to make it a better place for all Americans. And let me say this about my good friend John McCain. This country was making a serious mistake when it was kind of wanting a little bit of a provision for torturing prisoners of war. This is an unacceptable level of government in the fight against terrorism. Nothing could be worse than to torture the wrong person for what you think might be even a good cause. And so thus I say to you that when you ask the question, how are we doing in Los Angeles? Los Angeles County, in many respects, is leading the rest of the nation in bonding and building relationships that are longer and more enduring than just the fight against terror. My policy is not to just be your friend, but to do your dances, eat your food, listen to the music, and get out there and have a good time. That's what it's all about, enjoying each other. Thank you.
Any other questions for our panelists?
I can come to you.
Okay. This is specifically a question for Mr. Rollins, and perhaps also Mr. Gill could comment on it. You talked a lot about wanting to help the community, and I believe you very much when you say it. And we also heard about the case of, you know, Irv Rubin and Earl Krugel, who were attempting to attack Muslim and Arab American landmarks and organizations. Yet when we look at the sentences that they received in their plea bargain, and there was a madman in Florida who was wanting to blow up a mosque, I believe he got 15 years. Irv Rubin and Earl Krugel played out for 20 years. We look at Muslims who've been accused of terrorist attacks. Well, I can't think of one who got a plea bargain that was minimal. Normally, it's life, 80 years plus life, or if no charges stick, it goes into immigration court. If they happen to be a non-citizen, they're basically almost automatically deported. Are there elements that you see within the law enforcement community, within the Department of Justice, that push these forward? Does everybody have that same attitude that you do?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question, but if it's basically, are you asking me to comment on the disparity of sentences between... Boy, that's a hard one to ask me to comment on what other people do and don't want to do with the community. In terms of the sentencing, that is strictly up to the judge. The FBI does the investigative component of it, as do the state and local police, other federal agencies. The prosecutors are the ones that bring the case in front of a jury and the judge, and ultimately the judge makes the decision on how long that person is going to spend behind bars based on sentencing guidelines, which are now being looked at and reviewed and over-reviewed. So it is what it is. In terms of, does everybody want to help? Well, clearly, we talked about, and my colleague here mentioned a certain individual and a program that I've invested about 10,000 hours in trying to help Debbie Ramirez and Northeastern University get this off the ground, because I believe we do it right in Washington, and I believe you do it right here in Los Angeles, thanks to the work of my colleagues and sheriff and others. But there are many places where the community is not engaged with law enforcement. There are many places where it's broken, quite frankly. And my effort was to try to take this project, take the best practices, a phrase you hear a lot, from Los Angeles and from Chicago and from Washington, and put them in places like Boston where, quite frankly, it's broken. I said to the director, do we want to do this one way or do we want to do it 56 ways? And he said, one way. And then I guess my follow-on to that is, well, then why aren't we supporting this with the $1 million it's going to take to get it off the ground? So that's an internal debate. I wish everyone would be as committed to making this work. And let me make a couple points about the community, something I think is lost. We've conducted about 500,000 interviews post 9/11 relative to the attacks of 9/11. And this is important because your community gets painted as not doing enough and you could have helped. I'm not aware, and I know 9/11 about as well as anybody in the FBI knows 9/11, and that's not bragging, that's just the reality. I'm not aware of any single person in your community who, had they stepped forward, could have provided a clue to help us get out in front of this. The reality of that attack is that 19 people came here with what they needed. They spoke the language well enough to order meals and rent cars and hotel rooms. They had money coming in from overseas. 4 people knew how to fly planes, and 15 others were willing to be the muscle. They didn't need any witting help from anyone to do what they did. And thus far, and I'm not saying this is conclusive, because 10 years from now somebody might find something that changes it, we've not found a sitting, single, witting individual in your community. And that's a fact that gets overlooked, because you get painted. And that's why I'm so committed and remain committed to projects like this, because what we are in the business of is facts and the truth. I started off telling you I'm not into gossip and rumor, hyperbole and innuendo. Facts and the truth. Every one of those 762 people that were arrested post 9/11, every single one of them, without exception, was out of status. I know there are instances wherein somebody tried to change their status and it didn't work and it got hung up in the bureaucracy. But the reality was, and I think we need this frank conversation, if any one of those 762 want to know why they were arrested, look in the mirror. They could have done something to adjust that status so that it was what it should have been, and they wouldn't have had a problem. And this thought about, we just went out on sweeps looking to grab every Arab American or Muslim, I told Senator Feingold when he asked me in the Judiciary Committee, he said, isn't it true that the vast majority of those people were Muslim? I said, I don't know and I don't care. That is not a question an FBI agent necessarily should ever ask in an interview. It has nothing to do with the crime or the threat that's being investigated. I'm not interested in your religion. You're probably not interested in mine. I'm a Roman Catholic. If somebody ever came to me and interviewed me and asked me my religion, I'd tell them the same thing. None of your business. And another point that my colleague made before, which I do want to stress, we knock on your door, we're looking for help, you don't have to talk to us. Nobody in this country ever has to talk to the FBI when we come knocking on their door. I don't want to get into the lawyer part of it, but I don't disagree with anything he said. But you don't have to talk to us. And I'll stop there so that somebody else can ask a question.
Sure, go ahead. That said, I think it's also important, though, to recognize that Many cases which began as investigations of individuals who were considered to be national security threats later turned into cases where individuals violated their immigration status. And that is a problem because, number one, it casts suspicion on the community. Media runs with it. So automatically, all you hear is Muslim terrorists, Muslim investigated for terrorism, etc., right? Number two, it's a problem because it's inaccurate. These are individual, it's a national security threat is completely different from an immigration violation. Yes, both are against the law, and we're not promoting people to violate immigration status. However, we are saying, call it what it is. And when agents have been quick to label people being investigated as national security threats, that causes problems within the community that resonate among the community more than an immigration violation, whatever, right? So I think we must demand that, number one, it has to be very accurate. Whatever it is, call it what it is. And number two, going back to the issue of the double standard, absolutely. When we see somebody being investigated, a charity being shut down, assets frozen, because they are being suspected for financing terrorism, and yet we look at the JDL, and rather than the whole charity being indicted, it was the two individuals being indicted. That is a discrepancy, and that is a problem, and we must lobby our officials and demand equality.